We're going to be sharing our ideas of the characteristics of effective undergraduate projects and some of the characteristics of projects that don't realize their full potential. And the talk will actually be delivered by two of us. I'll do the first half, and Dr. Becky Simmons from the University of North Dakota will do the last half. Our mentor and co-author, Susan Weller, is in the audience. She won't actually be delivering any of this talk, but I'm sure she'll be free for questions during the discussion section. So we're going to approach this by first looking at the participants in the research projects and their respective goals. We'll then get into the successful projects that we've been involved in, and we'd like to highlight two models that we have participated in. Susan Weller's model at the University of Minnesota and Becky's model at the University of North Dakota. And then we'll get into reasons that we think some projects don't realize their potential. And then we'll end with a summary. So the participants, we have the undergraduates, and when they come looking for research projects, they contact a faculty advisor. For us, that's Susan and Becky. And in some cases, there are graduate students involved, which is how I became involved with undergraduate research, and postdocs or other scientists that are in the lab. And in all cases, the host department is involved and does have a hand in how the project goes sometimes. So all of these stakeholders have goals for the project, many of which overlap, but some of which are unique to each of these individuals. And so we're going to walk through some of those. Many of our undergraduates come to us looking primarily to fulfill credit hour requirements or requirements for their majors. In still other cases, they're really looking for lab experience. They want to acquire skills that they think will translate well when they go on to the next step, be it graduate school or professional school. And others are learning to build their teamwork skills. They want to know what it's like to work shoulder to shoulder with a scientist or, you know, other people in the lab, and build their leadership skills as well when they have enough information that they can take on a leadership role. Again, a lot of this is to build their CVs, and an important part of that is developing their critical thinking skills. So not just coming into a lab and doing things that they're told to do, but actually being involved in thinking about the project and contributing where they can. Intellectual stimulation is also a primary motivation for a lot of our undergrads. They come in wanting a learning environment outside of a classroom setting. So they want to work in the lab and be involved in science from that end. In all cases, we find that our undergrads are looking for a supportive environment. They want to work with people who are understanding of where they are and their learning scale and will be patient and take them to where they need to go to. The advisor most usually finds mentorship rewarding. They want to work with students, and this is why they get into this. And they're doing this for both their undergraduates and for any graduate students or postdocs or other scientists working in their lab. Of course, there is the bonus of furthering your research. You get these undergrads to help you collect your data and move your research agenda forward. Another goal is to have the student work in teams, and this serves multiple purposes. You want them to learn how to work with each other, but it's your opportunity as well to foster some peer mentoring where they can actually teach each other the skills that they need. And so the more advanced students can work with the newer students. And this is where I think it's a really good opportunity for an undergraduate to know that they can teach somebody something else. They're learning, and you can share what you know with the new undergrad, the new grad students sometimes don't know what you do. And you can share what you know. And again, improving student competence in a variety of skills. The graduate student goals, from my perspective, it was a huge opportunity for me to learn how to mentor students, to get them from where they were when they walked into the lab to the stage they wanted to get to. I was involved in the project design from the very beginning until to the end, and so I learned what it was like to design a project appropriate for an undergraduate. So it's very easy to dream huge projects that might not be appropriate for the amount of time that they have, the classes that they're taking. So it's a good opportunity to learn how to do that. And time management. Graduate students have their own research, their own classes that they're taking, and now you're helping someone else to do the same thing. And so you get a good idea of what it's like to manage your time effectively. When there are proposals to be written involving the undergraduate and yourself, you have the opportunity to learn how to do that. Now, the host department is usually looking for the faculty mentor to provide a nurturing learning environment, one in which the student acquires the skills they need to carry out the projects that they're doing, and also walk out of the department a much more scientifically literate person, someone with a better appreciation for what science is. Of course, they're also looking for faculty productivity and interested in recruiting the next generation of scientists from among those students who get turned on by the science and really feel like this is something they want to do. Now, you have an idea of what all these stakeholders want. What exactly, how do you go about designing a project? What are the characteristics we're going to look for to bring these up, to realize these goals? So I'll talk about the characteristics first, and then I'm going to highlight the Weller model, and then Becky is going to take over and talk about the Simmons model and take the talk to the end. So, from our experience, mentorship is huge. It is continuous. You start and you guide your students along more intensely at first, but as they become more advanced and they acquire the skills that you are teaching them, they become more independent and you can step back and give them more control as they're comfortable doing that. It's a supportive environment, and wherever possible, the student is involved in the planning of that project and in presentation of results. And this helps them to take ownership of the project. They feel like they're really involved. They're not just somebody who comes into the lab and you take their labor and they leave. They're involved and they know it. In the best of worlds, it's an independent and complementary unit of the advisor's research. That way you can capitalize on the expertise of the lab, and there's not too much outside, you're not going so far afield that it becomes a strain on the research. It's a doable project that overlaps with their interests, and that's something you figure out once they come in and they interview and they tell you what it is they want to do. And having a tangible outcome, something your student can show and say, here's what I've done, this is the result of my work. Projects, posters and papers are things that we've used to realize that. And these are things we think contribute to student development, enhancing their critical thinking skills, helping them to interpret their results and understand what their data means. And these will help them to make more informed judgments about data they have at hand. And again, they learn to work independently and collaboratively. We want to emphasize again that learning in a safe place is a very big deal for an undergraduate, for anybody working in the lab, actually. As a graduate student, I wanted learning in a safe place. Experiments, fieldwork, they don't always work, but it's not the end of your career. You don't have to pack up and go home because something didn't work in the lab. It's something that happens all the time, it happens to everybody, and this is your opportunity to learn from something that didn't work. What went wrong? How can I fix it? Can we fix it? Is there another way I can think about it? And they should feel comfortable asking for help from the advisor and from the other people working in the lab. I think sometimes it's a little bit scary when you have other people in the lab who seem to know everything and you've made a mistake. How do you tell somebody, is this really horrible? No, it's not. Ask for help. Everybody makes mistakes. And they develop confidence and become experts to train other people because they learn over time that this is something they can share with other people. Examples of some tangible outcomes. We've had posters presented at national meetings. We've had posters here at ESA. And we have some of our students who've become very competent in the lab and can work on their own, can train in other people. And Sarah, in your lower left, she's acquired employment with Becky and is here in our audience based on the skills she learned in the lab. So now I'm going to highlight one of the things we do in Susan's lab. So this is the Weller model at University of Minnesota. Whenever we have undergraduates coming in, they're involved in the planning process. They know where we are, why this particular question is interesting, and how it fits into the bigger picture in the lab. So how their work's going to contribute to moving the research agenda forward. The training and supervision, data analysis, everybody participates in that, grad students, postdocs, other people in the lab. And this works out well for two reasons. You help the undergrads get where they want to, and you help your junior scientists to learn how to work with the undergrads, and you help move everyone along that way. And there's always an open door policy. So if something goes wrong in the lab, You just absolutely can't go on because you broke something. You can go down to her office and talk about it. And you know you can come back another day. It's okay. All right, so now I'm going to show you one of the projects that I was involved in with an undergrad and with Susan. One of her research foci is the tiger moth. She reconstructs the evolutionary history of tiger moths, and that group of insects are family trees highlighted here in blue. When I was working in her lab as a grad student, I worked on a small part of that, calamorphines. When we had Peter, who we'll be talking to next, come in, we involved him in a part of my project. And so the way this was set up is that we had a series of nested projects. And so the bigger research was moving forward, and we all helped each other in small parts of that project. While he was working with me, we had the opportunity to train him in on the skills he would need to do his own project. And so he learned how to do DNA extraction and amplification, sequencing reactions, and sequence alignment. And now he's moved on. He's had RU-funded projects. He built his own family trees very independently. He works on butterflies, moths, and beetles. And he's given a talk here right after this one, and he's had a poster in the student competition. So we're really proud of Peter, and this is the kind of thing we think you can do with undergraduates when they come in really eager and you give them the opportunity to spread their wings. So now we're going to transition to the Simmons model, and Becky's going to take over from here.
Thank you, Michelle. And she's going to stay up here and be very supportive. I'm at the University of North Dakota, but I'm also a University of Minnesota graduate, so I've had the opportunity to work in the Weller model in much of the same way Michelle did. But at University of North Dakota, we're a slightly different type of institution. We're basically an undergraduate training institution. We have a general biology major. We do not have an entomology program. And so the courses I teach are very large courses, and we have about 700 majors that go through the program every year. So I recruit students from my coursework, people that are interested in maybe getting some more hands-on experience about hearing what they did in lecture. So from general biology to or evolution. And usually these students are not going to be entomologists unless we convert them. They're usually pre-med students. This young man right here, if I dare to, well, yeah, the pointer, which is safer from what I see. There we go. He's going to be a dentist or forensic biologist. Amy here is a forensic biologist, and that's what she wants to do. But DNA is DNA, whether it's in human or in insects. And so they can learn the techniques to take on to other professions. In my model, I find that a semester of servitude is necessary to complete before they get paid for their skills. The reason I require a semester of servitude is because, an unpaid semester, is because I have to turn away many, many students every semester. And so I want to see them there for at least two semesters so that they really understand what's going on. And I find that if they're committed enough to volunteer or take credit the first semester, that they'll stick around for longer than that. And it becomes a more worthwhile experience. In our department, laboratory experience is very valued. And so we use it as a class. Students have to take four laboratory requirements to complete their major in biology. And we actually use laboratory experience with individual professors as one of those classes. To standardize this across the department, we have a form that the student has to fill out and get approved by the student's advisor, the research mentor, and the chair. And in general, we require that for every credit hour they take, they do 20 hours in that semester in the laboratory. And at the end, they write about a 5-page paper detailing the methods and why they use the methods they do in that particular situation. As opposed to them working on one particular project, I involve my students in all projects in the laboratory. We find that this is a good strategy. It gives them an opportunity to work on a variety of techniques, and it also allows them to work in teams. So some of the projects they've worked on or are working on right now are the systematics of pest species. This is a haplotype tree of two pest species, Coptarsia and Coptarsia caruta. We've worked on higher level relationships of tortricids. We've worked on the evolution of life history behavior. And they work both on molecular data characters, collecting those characters, and in some morphological characters. This team approach, I feel, is very important in allowing students to understand basic methods and to get practice multiple times doing the same sort of skills. So a student might start a PCR, and then the next day another student might run out that PCR and visualize it on a mini gel. This gives them transferable skills that they can take on either in medical school research or as a technician in industry or in graduate school. And in fact, we encourage recruiting undergraduates as graduate students into our program. And the thing that I really like about this approach is that they really do form teams in our laboratories. We've been finding that students in our labs, in general, not only help each other well in the labs, they tend to meet outside the labs as well and form a study environment. So, for example, this young man, Jeff, is very good in physics. And so he helped his peers in the labs study for their physics tests. It was wonderful. A lot of pizza helps with this, too. Now, of course, we're all human, and not everything always works out the way we want it to. And we find that there's a couple of reasons that projects don't achieve full potential. And that's usually a problem between either the student is not invested intellectually, and that can be a very simple issue. It could be that the student suddenly realizes that research is just not what they wanted to do. They decide that they want to be an educator, an elementary school teacher, or they want to be a nurse, or they find out that this isn't it for them. And that's actually quite positive, because at that point, you've helped them decide what they don't want to do. There are so many choices in this world, and they're young. They have to figure out just as much what they don't like as much as what they do like. And then the second issue we're going to elaborate on a little more is a disconnect between the student and the advisor. We find that there are student-specific issues when there's a disconnect between the advisor and the student, as well as advisor-specific issues. One of the first specific issues we find is that there's personal life interference with the learning experience. And I can often think back to when I was about 18, 19, and I've had many of these experiences, and I'm sure you all can think of them as well. Things get in the way of this learning experience, like classes or jobs, families, social lives. These are very busy students. So what we try to do in my lab is minimize this conflict. We have a very flexible schedule. We actually have a whiteboard, wipe-off calendar, and they sign up when they're going to come in, and we're completely flexible with that. We also have a policy that if you have an exam, we do not want to see you in the lab. They're a student first, and that's important to remember. The second thing that we find is that the student may not be as intellectually prepared as we think that they are. They may be too nervous to tell you they don't understand something, or perhaps they just nod when you're telling them something, and there's a disconnect there, and they haven't been given all the information they need. And again, making the lab a safe place to learn usually helps with this part. We've also had students that are too social, and that makes them inattentive to the project. I can remember when I was working for Susan, I had my first encounter with this. We had a young lady, and she was very excited about being in the lab. And she was running a mini gel, and she made the buffer acidic, which is not a buffer at all. And it changed how the gel was running, and it melted the gel rig and caused an incident. So we try to remind students to concentrate on what they're doing. And finally, there may be an absence of students' initiative, either because they find that this isn't what they signed up for, or they're doing it to fill a slot or a requirement, and they're not really intellectually invested at all. And that can happen as well. And the best thing to do is spot it and talk to the student. Everyone wants to be a good advisor, and we do our best. And so some of the things that we can do to be a good advisor is to be sure to avoid communication style mismatches. I have sometimes this trouble. The student may understand, for example, if I say to the student, I'd really like to see you in the lab more. The student may hear, I just want to see you. And the student will come into the lab and not necessarily work or meet their goals when I should have said, I'm concerned about the progress you're making on your goals. And that way, the communication is more clear. The second thing that might happen is there might be unclear expectations, which may arise when the student and the advisor haven't outlined the project together. And finally, there might be a time where you assume that the student is prepared for independence when they just need a little more guidance. And we find to avoid these that written expectations, regular meetings, and open door policies are very helpful. And these are common sense sort of things, but also very helpful. In summary, we find that the benefits of undergraduate research make this all worthwhile. It's very helpful in professional development, not only for the student, but for ourselves as educators. The students are intellectually stimulated, and I often learn a lot from my students as well. We both achieve, in the best sense, tangible outcomes through publications and successes. There's increased productivity. For example, I can't get into the lab 40 hours a week anymore, but if I have 8 students working 5 hours a week, I kind of can. I don't have that many. I have 5 students, but it's still really great. And then it allows pedagogical training for graduate students. And that doesn't mean just students that stay at your institution. Susan shared with me that she had a student go on, and she's very successful at Duke. And that makes University of Minnesota look very good as well. So I just want to say that we're very proud of our students. We hope that we help them achieve the goals that they want to get while they're with us. And we'd like to thank them, thank our institutions, thank Bill Connor for helping develop this talk, and our funding sources that allow us to incorporate students in these ways. And thank you for your kind attention. And again,
now that was the list that's missing from the success or failure. I was talking philosophically. You filled in a lot of the holes as to what the real problems are, and those are crucial information to kind of get out.
Well, thank you. But I also, Michelle and Susan and I also think that, you know, everybody has their own style, and it's just sort of finding what works for people as well. But that there are commonalities that we do see. But individually, we tweak it, don't we?
Yeah.
At least
what are the typical problems with undergraduates in research and a lot of them too is that they tend not to be reliable. And maybe you could
we did have that issue, and at least in my experience when I started as a new faculty member, I'm not big on rules, so I hate making them. But now, because of experiences that we had, and my technician is sitting in the audience and nodding her head, we have that whiteboard calendar, and we have a rule that if you are coming in, we need to know you are coming in. You will sign up on that calendar. If you can't make it, it's not awful. Just give us a call. Let us know you're okay. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes I think what I've done is I've called them and said, you didn't come in. Are you hurt? And that makes them realize that they really are missed.
And they're cared about.
And that, one young man in the slide presentation had kidney stones over the summer, and so we would call and check on him and make sure he was all right. So it makes them feel like they're needed, and they are needed and loved. So what do you find about reliability?
When our undergrad, we've always asked them to let us know if they can't come in, and they've been very good about either emailing or calling before, you know, they're supposed to come in, so we know that they're not going to come in. And in the cases where they haven't done that, they've been very quick about doing it very soon after, so that we know.
I don't know whether it's because we're in the Midwest, too, so I don't know. I've noticed that kids in the Midwest are very earnest, and I'm from the East Coast.
just one last comment. When you have a chronically unreliable student, being in the lab is a privilege, not a right.
Exactly. And when I've seen things go like that, I often just pull them aside and I'll say, I need to talk to you in private. I bring them into my office and I say, I feel that we're having a disconnect here and this is what's going on. And usually that's a wake-up call. And I'll give them a time period where I say, well, you've got 2 to 4 weeks to work this out. If we find things haven't improved, perhaps this isn't working for both of us. And then we'll end the experience. And that's sad, but it does happen.